The test is in four parts, part 1, part 2, part 3, and part 4. Now look at part 1.
Part 1.
You will hear a conversation between a travel agent and a customer. The customer wants to book a coach ticket. First, you have some time to look at questions 1 to 3. Now we shall begin. You should answer the questions as you listen, because you will not hear the recording a second time. Listen carefully and answer questions 1 to 3.
Good morning. I'd like to book a coach to London. I was hoping you had something available this Saturday afternoon.
Good morning, sir. Take a seat and I'll just check for you. Yes. We still have several free seats for Saturday. Where will you be leaving from? There are 3 pickup points in town: Main Street, Centenary Square, or the Central Bus Station.
From Centenary Square, please. That's easier for me to get to than the bus station.
And what time would you like to leave? There are coaches on the hour every hour, from 12 through till 6 p.m.
Well, I'm meeting someone at the station in London and I need to be there for 4:30. So, which one would you recommend?
Well, there's one leaving at 1 that arrives at Victoria Station at 4:10, if that's any good. Traffic is usually quite light at the weekend and the drivers tend to make good time, so I think you'd certainly be there for 4:30.
OK, that sounds just right. I think I'll take that. I can always phone ahead if I'm going to be late.
And when are you returning, sir?
Actually, I'm not sure when I'll be coming back, so I won't book a return ticket, just one way.
I can always book you an open return if you'd like. You can use this at any time within the next month, as long as you contact us first to reserve a seat.
Well, there's a chance I might be getting a lift back, you see, so I'll just pay for one way. I don't want to buy a return if I don't need it.
OK, no problem. Are you travelling alone?
Just the one ticket, please. I'm going down to visit my daughter at university. My son's meeting me at the station, so it's a proper family reunion.
Before you hear the rest of the conversation, you have some time to look at questions 4 to 10. Now listen and answer questions 4 to 10.
Very nice. OK, well, I can book that for you if you like, sir. That'll be £23.50. Now, I just need to take down some details. Can I have your name, please?
Yes, it's Matthew Upton. That's U-P-T-O-N.
And your address?
34 Allesley Road, Allesley. That's A-L-L-E-S-L-E-Y.
And your telephone number?
01732-558-997.
And your email address? We'll use this to send confirmation of your travel details.
matt257@yahoo.co.uk.
OK, thanks.
Before I forget, I'll be taking a little luggage. Is there a set luggage allowance?
We offer a very good luggage allowance. You can take 2 suitcases as long as they're no more than 20 kilos each. That's 40 kilos in total, and 1 small item of hand luggage on the coach. Most people find that more than adequate. Any additional items carry an extra charge of £10 for each bag.
I certainly won't be taking that much, so I should be okay. I was worried I might be taking too much.
Would you like travel insurance included with your ticket? It's an additional £2.
No, I don't think so.
No problem. It's not compulsory. Okay. How will you be paying?
Actually, I've been having trouble with my debit card today, and I've left my chequebook at home, so I'd better pay in cash. You'll give me a receipt, won't you?
Certainly, and we'll send confirmation to your email address as well. So that's £23.50, sir. If you just wait a minute, I'll print you off a receipt.
That is the end of part one.
You now have half a minute to check your answers.
Now it turns to part two.
Part two.
You will hear a woman talking about health and safety when using a computer. First, you have some time to look at questions. Listen carefully to the first part of the talk and answer questions. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the second session on health and safety. And today we're focusing on health and safety when using a computer. Now, can you all gather round this workstation here? That's great, thanks. Okay, now, let's look at some equipment that is specifically designed for safe computer use. Firstly, take a look at this item here. Yes, the sloped slab in front of the keyboard. Does anyone know what it is? That's right. It's a wrist rest. And it does a lot more than take up room on your desk, I can tell you. Well, what does it do exactly? In actual fact, it's specifically designed to support your wrist when you're typing or when you're using a computer mouse. Now, the one I'm holding in my hand is made of foam rubber. Come on now, have a feel. You know you want to. Now, it's very flexible, isn't it? The padding is firm, but it also gives way when you press it, just like this. Here's another type, by the way. This one is filled with gel. Now, like the foam rubber type, it's got a firm surface, but when you press it like this, it gives way with a little spring. However, not all wrist rests are flexible like that. Some are made from hard plastic. That doesn't sound like a comfortable support for your wrist, does it? So, not to be recommended. Okay. So, we know what kind of material we're looking for in a wrist rest. But what else do we have to think about before we choose one? Now, look again at the foam rubber wrist rest here. You can see that the slope of the wrist rest and the height and the width too match the front edge of the keyboard here. And there are no sharp edges. Look. It's really nice and smooth. Now, we know it's a busy time for you all at the moment. You're busy with assignments in between the hours you're spending browsing the net and going on social networking sites. Well, just think about how hard your wrist has to work. So, using a wrist rest like this one can really help in a number of ways. First of all, It helps you keep your wrist straight when you're using your computer. I'm demonstrating this now. As you can see, my wrist is neutral and straight rather than bent up and down. See what I mean? Now, it can also provide padding for your hands. It works in much the same way as a cushion, so it makes your desk much more comfortable. Now, please note, I did say cushion rather than pillow. We don't want you students to be too comfortable. Another advantage of a wrist rest is that it stops your hands from dropping off the edge of the keyboard. A wrist rest can also relieve tension and soreness in your neck and shoulders. And how does it do that exactly? Well, it removes the weight of your arm from your shoulders and neck altogether. So there are a lot of benefits, aren't there? However, most people never learn how to use a wrist rest correctly. In fact, leaning your wrists on a wrist rest for long periods can put a lot of pressure on the undersides of your wrists, just here. Now you have some time to look at questions 18 to 20. Now listen to the rest of the talk and answer questions 18 to 20. So, to make the most of your wrist rest, it's really important to follow a few basic tips. First of all, make sure you place your wrist rest approximately 1.5 inches away from your keyboard, like this. And never ever place your wrists directly on your wrist rest. Instead, place the palm or ball of your hand on the rest. And another thing, don't use the wrist rest all the time, particularly when you're typing. Instead, your hands should be on the wrist rests during break periods, so between your typing sessions. This will avoid you putting strain on your wrists and fingers. Now, does anyone have any questions before we move on to computer glasses?
That is the end of part two.
You now have half a minute to check your answers.
Now it turns to part three.
Part three.
You will hear three students talking about how to spend their time before going to university.
First, you have some time to look at questions 21 to 25. Now, listen carefully and answer questions 21 to 25.
What's that you're reading, Matt?
Oh, hi, Tara. It's an article about taking a gap year before going to university.
Is that what you're thinking of doing, then?
Well, I hadn't really considered it as an option, but reading this has got me thinking. I'm looking forward to starting at uni, but I wouldn't mind a bit of time to myself first.
Hi, guys. What are you talking about?
Hi, Sandy.
How's it going?
Matt's reading about gap years. He wants to put off going to uni.
I think a gap year's a great idea. I'm definitely thinking about it.
Are you? What would you do with the year?
Well,
The programmes I've looked at involve volunteering of some kind. I wouldn't want to just go travelling for a year. I couldn't afford that anyway. The idea would be to work and help people, but more importantly, to grow up and come back knowing more about the world than I do now. Obviously, I'd choose somewhere hot and sunny.
So, what exactly is volunteering? I mean, OK, I understand it means doing something for nothing, but what does it mean in terms of a gap year?
Yeah, it means working with programmes in countries where people need support or some kind of aid.
Hmm. I bet your mum and dad aren't quite as enthusiastic as you are about all this.
On the contrary, they're really supportive. They can see all the pluses. They realise that I don't know exactly where I want to be in 10 years' time. They think it'll give me time to figure things out and not make decisions I might regret later.
I think I'd be worried about how the university look at it, though. Don't you think it suggests you're just putting off studying?
Definitely not. Our tutor told us that a lot of universities encourage students to take a gap year. They see a year away growing up and maturing as an asset. Students arrive in higher education with an extra year of life experience, depending on what you do with the time, obviously.
Yes, I can see that tutors might like having a few well-travelled students around. I mean, ones that have a more developed perspective.
I think they also appreciate that students who come back from a year away, doing something worthwhile, have a stronger sense of direction and a clearer idea of what they hope to achieve. They probably speak at least a few words of another language too. The most important thing for the unis is that students are motivated.
So anyway, what does your article say about the options? Do they suggest where students should go on their gap year?
You now have some time to look at questions 26 to 30. Now listen to the rest of the discussion and answer questions 26 to 30.
Well, apparently, Australia's the country where the highest percentage of students take a gap year, and it's the most popular destination for gap year students from other countries as well as Britain.
I like the sound of a year in Australia.
They say here that there are three main attractions. The abundance of Great Coast, beautiful beaches, learn to surf, all that stuff. Then there's the amount of time you can spend enjoying outdoor activities, like hiking and loads of sports. And thirdly, the cosmopolitan cities, especially Sydney, which apparently is awesome. It's a great country for young people because there's so much to do. Loads of adventure and sunshine, obviously.
Sounds good to me.
Unfortunately, it says here the cost of getting there in the first place can be prohibitive. However you make your way there, it's expensive. Unless the bank of mum and dad help out, that is. Then, look, they also mention various places in Africa, but they single out Ghana. Students can get involved with the construction of new schools or teaching the kids that are already in them.
That does sound really rewarding and interesting, I have to say. I guess there's a huge sense of achievement with something like that, and you get fantastic life experience from living in another culture.
I think you pick up some real practical skills too, skills you can bring back with you.
Another place I really like the sound of is Nepal.
What's the attraction there?
Most of the volunteering involves teaching again, and it's that sense of achievement that people are after. They also say, let me read it, students are attracted by the simplicity of daily existence. I think they mean you have to spend a year without your computer and all the rest of it. It's all about going back to basics.
So where do people stay?
They live on farms or in mountain retreats.
I'm not so sure I could manage that. I don't mind hard work, but I like a hot shower at the end of the day.
Yeah, I imagine the food's not great either.
They do actually say here that one of the things volunteers miss is good food choices. Anyway, there are plenty of other options. Why don't you read the rest of the...
That is the end of part three.
You now have half a minute to check your answers.
Now turns to part four.
Part four.
You will hear a lecture on climate change. First, you have some time to look at questions 31 to 40. Listen carefully and answer questions 31 to 40.
This lecture in environmental studies is on the topic of human influence on climate change. First, I'll outline some of the factors affecting climate, then go on to discuss what has already occurred, and finish up by speculating on the effects. Previously, we've covered how factors such as ocean currents and prevailing winds affect climate change naturally. However, the influence of human activity on climate is what I'll talk about today. At first, the effect on the climate was relatively small. Trees were cut down to provide fuel for fires, and, as we know, trees absorb carbon dioxide and produce oxygen, so the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere would have increased, but not noticeably. So, in what ways has human activity really impacted on the climate? A major contributor was the advent of the Industrial Revolution at the end of the 18th century, combined with the invention of the combustion engine. In addition, Earth's burgeoning population has had a marked effect on climate. The first two factors saw increased amounts of carbon dioxide being released into the atmosphere from the burning of fossil fuels, such as coal and oil. The final one, human expansion, has resulted in deforestation on such a scale that the extra carbon dioxide in the air cannot be soaked up and converted into oxygen by the remaining trees. Okay, so what has already happened? Well, global temperatures have risen by 0.6 degrees Celsius in the last 130 years. Levels of carbon dioxide, methane, and nitrous oxide gases have escalated. Carbon dioxide concentrations have climbed by 30%, and methane levels have increased by 145% since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. Gas, produced by fossil fuel extraction, livestock, and paddy fields, is primarily responsible for the growth of methane levels. Nitrous oxide, or N2O, comes from natural sources, wet tropical forests, for instance. But it is also produced by human-related activities, such as agriculture, which uses synthetic nitrogen fertilizers, rubbish disposal systems, and vehicle emissions. How do gases like carbon dioxide and methane affect the climate? Well, this is what we call the greenhouse effect. Under normal conditions, the sun's rays hit the Earth and some are reflected back into space. However, these gases, CO2 and methane, create a barrier in the atmosphere, which prevents a proportion of the sun's rays from being reflected back into space. And, instead, the gases become trapped in the atmosphere. It's simple, really. Because the sun's rays can't escape, the Earth heats up. What are the possible effects? Firstly, a rise in sea levels. We already know that the Arctic ice cap has melted and shrunk considerably, and great chunks of ice have been lost from Antarctica. In 1998, it was reported that 46 million people lived in areas at risk of flooding, and the number of people at risk will increase significantly if sea levels rise. It is estimated that a rise of only 50 centimeters would put that number at 92 million. Further projections would see a rise of 1 meter put 118 million people in danger of losing their homes and livelihoods, not to mention the loss of prime, fertile farmland. Experts predict a rise of at least 50 centimeters over the next 50 years or so. Secondly, there would be a modification of vegetation zones, with changes in the boundaries between grassland, shrubland, forest, and desert. This is already causing famine in arid areas of northeastern Africa, and has instigated, and will continue to instigate, mass movements of people away from dry regions. What we are seeing now is only the first stage, with temporary camps for climate refugees already at overcapacity. In the future, there will be significant migration resulting in extreme overcrowding of towns and cities. Another potentially disastrous effect of climate change is an increase in the range and distribution of pests, which could bring about an increase in the prevalence of certain diseases. If we think of the malaria-carrying mosquito, for example, which thrives in warmer regions, at the moment, about 45% of the world's population is exposed to malaria. But, with an increase in temperature, there will be many millions more cases of malaria a year. The last effect I'm going to mention today is the change in ecosystems. Global warming will influence species composition for both fauna and flora, such that some animal species will disappear and others will multiply. And it'll be the same for plants and trees. It is predicted that around 2/3 of the world's forests will undergo major changes of some kind. Scientists also expect deserts will become hotter, and, of course, desertification will continue at an increasingly worrying rate, and will become harder, if not impossible, to reverse. What can we do to stop the process? Well, that's the subject of next week's lecture. So, I hope to see you all there.
That is the end of part 4.
You now have half a minute to check your answers.